brought to you by breadboxmedia.com.
Just setting the record straight with Chuck Coughlin. How you doing today?
In this program, we're going to talk about something that we need to have great gratitude to God for.
The greatest naval battle in history is unfortunately one that is little known to many people in this country, since it was won by a coalition of Catholic countries called the Holy League, primarily Spain. It was the Battle of Lepanto that took place in October of 1571, when a fleet of the Holy League, a coalition of southern European Catholic maritime state led by Spain, decisively defeated the fleet of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was the greatest Muslim empire of the time. The battle occurred on the northern edge of the Gulf of Corinth off western Greece. The Ottoman forces sailing westward from their naval station in Lepanto met the Holy League forces, came from Messina in Sicily, where they had gathered. The victory of the Holy League prevented the Ottoman Empire from expanding further along the European side of the Mediterranean. The Battle of Lepanto was the last major naval battle in the Mediterranean that was fought entirely with galleys and has been assigned great symbolic and historic importance. There was a man, Gian Andrea Doria. He carried on his galley a gift from the King of Spain, an image that is now displayed in the Doria Chapel in the cathedral in Genoa. Exactly 40 years before the Battle of Lepanto, the Blessed Virgin appeared to a peasant boy, leaving a miraculous image of herself on his smock. The bishop of the region immediately commissioned an artist to paint 5 copies of the image, and he touched each one to the original. The image was that of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and she was present at Lepanto. And growing up in the United States, we learn about the importance of the year 1492, Columbus's discovery of the New World, landing at San Salvador. But it's often left out of our education that in that same year, the heroic Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, conquered the Muslims in Granada. They drove them out of the Iberian Peninsula after a Muslim domination of that peninsula of basically Portugal, Spain, and France for over 700 years. For 700 years, the Spanish Catholics had been second-class citizens, dhimmis, living in dhimmitude under the Moors. When great naval contests, most Americans do learn about the defeat of the Spanish Armada by Francis Drake and the rest of Britain's pirates under Queen Elizabeth. Of course, it took a storm to sink them across the northwest coast of the British Isles. That was in 1588. But what is called by many the greatest naval battle in Western history, the battle that saved the Christian West from being Muslim, was actually the Battle of Lepanto. That occurred 17 years before the sinking of the Spanish Armada. And this important naval contest is just not well known to Americans. As I said, October 7th, the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary, celebrates that victory, the battle that saved the Christian West from the Ottoman Turks. Yes, an important image of Our Lady of Guadalupe was on board, as were many crucifixes. That this military triumph is a Marian feast underscores our image of the Blessed Virgin, prefigured in the Canticle of Canticles. Quote, "Who is she that cometh forth as the morning, rising, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, terrible as an army set in array?" Well, how did all this come about? Well, 7 years before that, viziers of the divan of the Ottoman Empire assembled to urge their sultan prepare for war with Malta. They told him, "Many more difficulties have fallen to your scimitar than the capture of a handful of men on a tiny little island that is not even very well fortified." Their words were flattering but true. During the 5-decade reign of Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottoman Empire grew to its fullest glory, encompassing the Caucasus, the Balkans, Anatolia, the Middle East, and North Africa. Suleiman had conquered Aden, Algiers, Baghdad, Belgrade, Budapest, Rhodes, and Temeswar. His war galleys terrorized not only the Mediterranean Sea, but the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf as well. His one defeat was at the gates of Vienna, a famous victory for the Catholics in 1529 under Joseph Sobieski. Another name that should be celebrated in our history books, Joseph Sobieski, The advisors of the vizier had been ridiculing the tiny little island of Malta, which sits in an important point in the center of the Mediterranean. What's Malta like? It's an infertile, dusty rock with so few natural springs that the Maltese have to collect rainwater in large clay urns. The island could sustain only the smallest population. Yet this little island guarded the Mediterranean passage from the Islamic East to the Christian West. It does have excellent natural harbors, so the galleys of the Knights of St. John could sail forth from these harbors and disrupt any Turkish assault on Italy. They could also board and seize Turkish merchantmen carrying goods from France or Venice to be sold in the markets of Constantinople. The ladies of Suleiman's harem, who accumulated great wealth speculating in glass and other Venetian luxuries, nagged the Sultan to take Malta. Suleiman had bigger goals than pleasing these matrons. And he knew that in Turkish possessions, the harbors of Malta would afford him a base from which to continue his raids on the coast of Italy. It wasn't just treasure he was after, it was slaves. Tens of thousands of slaves. He had already captured tens of thousands of European slaves. Indeed, they manned his galleys. With a greater control of the sea that taking Malta would afford him, he would be able to bring Venice to his heel. An invasion of Sicily would be possible. Suleiman's greatest dream, however, and the dream of all Turks, the dream his soldiers toasted before setting off on every campaign, was the conquest of Rome. There, the Muslims could transform Michelangelo's St. Peter's, then under construction, into a mosque, just as they had done Constantinople's Hagia Sophia more than a century before. And the Hagia Sophia still remains in their hands today, its artworks and mosaics stripped out of it, as a result of Islam's puritanical Islamic iconoclasm. Though the Sultan had led his army on 12 major campaigns, this time his age would keep him home. So Suleiman was not there. The Turks sailed for Malta in the spring of 1565. By mid-May, their fleet was spotted offshore. That night, Jean de Valette, the 71-year-old Grand Master of the Knights of St. John, led his warriors into their chapel, where they went to confession, and then assisted at the holy sacrifice of the Mass. Jean de Valette spoke to his troops. He said, "A formidable army, composed of audacious barbarians, is descending on this island. These persons, my brothers, are the enemies of Jesus Christ. Today it is a question of the defense of our faith. Are the Gospels to be superseded by the Koran? God on this occasion demands of us our lives, already vowed to his service. Happy will be those who first consummate this sacrifice." Many of Jean de Valette's 700 knights and their men at arms did just that. While Europe stood idly by, expecting the fortress to fall, the knights held their island against an Ottoman army of 40,000. Including 6,500 of the Sultan's elite Janissaries. Now, I hope you know who the Janissary Guards are. At that time, they were the world's greatest army. And they were composed entirely of European boys that had been kidnapped when they were 10 years old and raised as Muslims, taken away from their families. So when the Knights of St. John were fighting the Ottoman army that included 6,500 Janissaries, they were their own countrymen grown up after being kidnapped and raised as slaves and forced to fight. Three quarters of the Turkish army were killed over the four-month siege before the Ottoman survivors turned back and straggled back to Constantinople. So Suleiman lost three quarters of his army of 40,000. Suleiman was outraged. "I see that it is only in my own hand that my sword is invincible," exploded the Sultan. And by May of the following year, he was leading an army of 300,000 men across the plains of Hungary, bound for Vienna. When the Hungarian Count of Sigetvar, a fortress city on the eastern frontier of the Roman Empire, led a successful raid on the Ottoman supply trains, Suleiman wheeled his massive army and swore to wipe the city off the map. Turkish engineers prepared flotillas and bridges to span the Drava and Danube rivers, to lay siege to Sitigavar. To greet the Sultan and to inspire his men, who were outnumbered 50-1, Count Miklos Zrinyi raised a large crucifix over his battlements and fired his cannons in defiance. but Zerini knew that in a Hungary infested with Protestantism, hope of relief was even fainter than any the knights of Malta had entertained on Malta the previous year. For nearly a month, wave after wave of Muslim infantry was thrown back from the walls. Suleiman offered Zerini rule of all Croatia if he would yield his city, but he answered, "No one shall point his finger on my children in contempt." When the breaches made by the Muslim artillery were too large to defend, the Catholic count assembled his last 600 men. He shouted as he held his bejeweled sword aloft, "With this sword I earn my first honor and glory. I want to appear with it once more before the eternal throne to hear my judgment." Charging out of the remains of their stronghold, was swallowed by a sea of Muslims. To the last man, the Hungarian knights died defending the Christian West. The Muslims, furious at the losses their army had suffered, consoled themselves according to their grisly custom. They slaughtered every Christian civilian who had survived the siege. Suleiman the Magnificent did not live to witness the massacre. He had died of dysentery 4 days earlier. Had he survived, however, this victory would have given him no comfort. The capture of Zigitvar was an empty victory. The Muslim army of the Ottoman Empire had exhausted itself. It was in no condition to carry on the campaign. It's time for a breakdown. This is Chuck Coughlin, uncovering some forgotten pages in history, some of the most important pages about the greatest naval battle in history.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Chuck Coughlin back with you on Setting the Record Straight.
Today's program is about the Battle of Lepanto, one of the greatest naval battles in history, if not the greatest.
Though they all died, Count Zerini and his heroic band actually were the true victors. Back in Constantinople, Suleiman's son ascended the throne by the usual Ottoman method, a complex harem intrigue designed to eradicate his worthier brothers. Unlike every previous sultan, Selim II, nicknamed the Sot, had little interest in warfare. His enthusiasms were for wine, his extraordinarily deviant sexual appetite, wine, poetry, and wine. Nevertheless, he sensed that without a decisive victory, the mighty empire his father had left him would be eclipsed. We're talking about Suleiman's son, who ascended to the throne when his father died. He had a tremendous appetite for wine, great wine. And overall, he had very little interest in warfare, just was a pleasure seeker. But he did attack Cyprus. The son, Selim II, invaded Cyprus in part because it was a source of his favorite vintage. Half the population were Greek Orthodox serfs, laboring under the exacting rule of their Venetian Catholic masters. They offered little resistance. The Venetian Senate was half-hearted about fighting for the island. Upon receiving word of the invasion, the members of the Senate voted by a very small margin of 220 to 199 to defend it. The Turks rolled through Cyprus, and after a 46-day siege, the capital city of Nicosia fell on September 9, 1570. The 500 Venetians in one garrison surrendered on terms. But once the city gates were open, the Turks rushed in and slaughtered them. Then they turned on the civilian population, massacring 20,000 people, some in such bizarre ways that those merely put to the sword were lucky. Every house was plundered. To protect their daughters from rape, the mothers stabbed them and then themselves, or threw themselves from the rooftops. Still, 2,000 of the better-looking boys and girls were gathered and shipped off as sexual provender for the slave markets in Constantinople. Then God intervened and sat in one of history's greatest popes, St. Pius V, who declared, "I'm taking up arms against the Turks, but the only thing that can help me is the prayers of priests of pure life." The Pope faced two foes, not only Islam, but Protestantism. He was up to the task. He had served as Grand Inquisitor, and the austerity of his private mortifications was a contrast to the lifestyles of his Renaissance predecessors. During his 6-year reign, he promulgated the Council of Trent, published the works of Thomas Aquinas, issued the Roman Catechism, and a new missal and breviary, created 21 cardinals, excommunicated Queen Elizabeth, and aided by St. Charles Borromeo, and led the reform of a soft and degenerate clergy, an episcopacy. Yes, he was pope for only 6 years, but it was a papacy of great achievements. The greatest came on March 7th of 1571, the feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. At the Dominican Church of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva in Rome, Pope Pius V formed the Holy League, Genoa and the Papal States and the Kingdom of Spain and the Kingdom of Spain put aside their jealousies and pledged to assemble a fleet of allies capable of confronting the Sultan's war galleys before the east coast of Italy became the next front in the war between Christianity and Islam. The day was not a total triumph, though. Venice refused to join. Though they were already at war with the Turkish Empire over Cyprus, the Venetians never failed to consider their economy. They might as well lose Cyprus, but a fast peace afterward would lead to the resumption of normal trade relations with the Turks. Moreover, the loss of the Venetian fleet in an all-out sea battle with the Sultan's galleys would be a disaster for a state so dependent on seaborne commerce. Walking back across the Tiber, the old monk that was Pope Pius V, wept for the future of Christendom. He knew that without the galleys of Venice, there was no hope of a fleet strong enough to face the Turks. It wasn't just Venice. The rest of Europe ignored Pius's call for a new crusade. Most of the rest of Europe was Protestant. They were Christian, but they failed to see the threat. In fact, Elizabeth I, Queen of England, through her spymaster, Sir Francis Walsingham, actively enlisted the aid of the Turks in her wars against Spain. France had openly traded with the Turks for years, and as recently as 1569, had drawn up an extensive commercial treaty with them. For years, the French had allowed Turkish ship to harbor in Toulon, and the oars that rowed Turkish galleys came from Marseille. The cannons that brought down the walls of Sigatovar were of French design. With Venice at war with Constantinople, markets once filled by Venetian goods were open to France, redeeming France from their utter disgrace were the Knights of St. John of Malta, who set their galleys to join the Holy League, eager to do battle with Islam. As the Pope prayed for Venice to answer a higher call, a new breed of fiery priests, led by stirring preachers like St. Francisco Borgia, Superior General of the Jesuits, inflamed the hearts of Christian emperors throughout the Mediterranean with their sermons against Islam. Enough Venetians must have been listening, because on May 25th, Venice at last joined the Holy League by fits and starts, with hesitation and quarreling on the part of a few of the principal players. The fleet of the Holy League was forming up. The man chosen by Pius V to serve as Captain General of the Holy League was Don Juan of Austria, the illegitimate son of the late Roman Emperor Charles V. The young commander had distinguished himself in combat against Barbary corsairs. Barbary corsairs are also Muslims. He also had distinguished himself in the Morisco Rebellion in Spain, a campaign in which he demonstrated his capacity for swift violence when the threat called for it, and restraint when charity demanded it. Don Juan of Austria was a great soldier. He was a great horseman, a great swordsman, and a great dancer. With charm, wit, and good looks in abundance, he was very popular among the ladies of the court. Since childhood, he had cultivated a deep devotion to the Blessed Virgin. He spoke Latin, French, Italian, and Spanish. He kept a pet marmoset and a lion cub that slept at the foot of his bed. The young man in charge of the forces was just 24 years old. Taking the young warrior by the soldiers, Pope Pius V looked at Don Juan of Austria in the eye and declared, "The Turks, swollen by their victories, will wish to take on our fleet. And God, I have the pious presentiment, will give us victory. Charles V gave you life. I will give you honor and greatness. Go and seek them out." In late summer of 1571, as Don Juan was making his way to the harbor at Messina to take command of his fleet, the situation on Cyprus was growing more desperate. The Venetian colonists had claimed the lives of some 50,000 Muslims with their intrepid defense of Famagusta. But when their gunpowder and supplies were exhausted, and when they had eaten their last horse, their shrewd governor, Marcantonio Bragadino, sent a message to the Turkish commander, Lala Mustafa, asking for terms of surrender. The Muslim Turks agreed to give the remaining Venetian soldiers passage to Crete on 14 Turkish vessels in exchange for the surrender of the city. The Greek Cypriots would be allowed to retain their property and their religion. That was the agreement. So on August 4th, 1571, Bragadino, with a small entourage, including several young pages, met with Mustafa and his advisors in the Turkish general's tent. Mustafa lecherously demanded Bragadino's page, Antonio Quirini, as a hostage for the 14 galleys. When Bragadino calmly refused, he and his men were pushed out of the tent by Mustafa's guard. Bragadino was bound and forced to watch as his attendants were hacked to pieces. The pages were led off in chains. Three times, the Muslims thrust Bragadino's neck on the executioner's block, but three times they lifted it off. Instead of his head, they cut off his nose and ears. To prevent his bleeding to death, they cauterized the wounds with hot irons. The Venetian soldiers of the garrison, unaware that Mustafa had broken the terms of the surrender, began their march down to the galleys, expecting passage to Crete. Once aboard, the Venetians were set upon by Turkish soldiers, who stripped them of their clothes and chained them to the oars. From their benches, they witnessed some of the horrifying ordeals to which the Turks now subjected Bragadino. First, the Turks fitted the governor with a harness and bridle and led him around the Turkish camp on his hands and knees. Panniers filled with dung were slung across his back. Each time he passed Lala Mustafa's tent, he was forced to kiss the ground. Then he was strung up in chains, hoisted over a galley spar, and left dying for a time. Finally, the courageous governor was dragged into the city square and lashed to the pillory, where the Turks flayed him alive. Witnesses said they heard him whispering a Latin prayer. One person said he died, quote, "when the executioner's knife reached the height of his navel," unquote. The diabolical orgy did not end there. Mustafa had the governor's skin stuffed, hoisted it on the mast of his galley, and joined the Ottoman fleet headed west. As Bragadino was losing his life to the Turkish monsters, Don Juan was inspecting his ships. It's time for a break. This is Chuck Coughlin, bringing the record forward and setting the record straight about the Battle of Lepanto, perhaps the greatest naval battle in history.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Chuck Coughlin back with you after the break. This is Setting the Record Straight. As Bragadino was losing his life to the Turkish monsters, Don Juan was inspecting his ships. Of the 206 galleys and 76 smaller boats that constituted the Holy League fleet, more than half came from Venice. The next largest contingent came from Spain, and included galleys from Sicily, Naples, Portugal, and Genoa. The galleys from Genoa were owned by the Genovese admiral, Gian Andrea Doria. Not only was Doria renting his services and the use of his ships to Philip at cost 30% higher than Philip paid to run his own galleys, he was lending the money to the Spanish king at 14%. That's an unheard of interest rate in those days. It was usury. The balance of the galleys came from the Holy See. Don Juan took charge of his fleet and promptly forbade women from coming aboard the galleys. He declared that blasphemy among the crews would be punishable by death. The whole fleet followed his example and made a 3-day fast. They set out across the Adriatic Sea, and by September 28th were anchored between the west coast of Greece and the island of Corfu. By this time, news of the death of Bragadino had reached the Holy League, and the Venetians were determined to settle a score. Don Juan reminded his fleet that the battle that they would soon engage in was as much spiritual as physical. Pope Pius V had granted a plenary indulgence to the soldiers and crews of the Holy League, priests of the great orders, Franciscans, Capuchins, Dominicans, Theatines, and Jesuits, were stationed on the decks of the Holy League's galleys, offering Mass and hearing confessions. For many, they would be the final confession. Many of the men who manned the oars of the Christian galleys were criminals serving sentences. Don Juan ordered them all unchained, and he issued each of them a weapon, promising them their freedom if they fought bravely. He then gave every man in his fleet a weapon more powerful than anything the Turks could muster. He gave every man in his fleet a rosary. The ultimate weapon, the weapon more powerful than anything the Muslims could muster. A rosary for each man. On the eve of battle, the men of the Holy League prepared their souls by falling to their knees on the decks of their galleys and praying the rosary. Back in Rome, and up and down the Italian peninsula, at the behest of Pope Pius V, the churches were filled with the faithful. All sang the rosary. In heaven, the Blessed Mother, her immaculate heart aflame, was listening. In the quiet of the night, Don Juan met with his admirals on the deck of his flagship, Real, to review once more the order of the battle. He had divided his fleet into 4 squadrons. Commanding the squadron on his left flank was a Venetian warrior named Agustin Barbarigo. The center squadron was commanded by Don Juan, assisted on either side by his vice-admirals, the Roman Marcantonio Colonna and the Venetian Sebastian Veniero. Directly behind the central squadron, Don Juan stationed the reserve squadron, commanded by the Spaniard Don Alvaro de Bazan, the Marquis of Santa Cruz. The right squadron was under the command of the Genovese Gian Andrea Doria. Arrayed for the battle, the mighty armada of the Holy League looked like nothing if not a Latin cross. Doria, despite his mercenary motives, had been the source of sound tactical counsel. He told Don Juan, cut off the spars in the prows of the fleet's galleys. Galleys had been equipped with bow spars or rams since the days of the Salamis. Doria said, this will permit the centerline bow cannons to depress further and fire their rounds at the waterline of the enemy hulls. Don Juan's famous order to remove these spars was an important moment in naval warfare, heralding the age of gunpowder. Doria also advised taking the League's 6 galleasses and stationing them in the van, 2 before each of the 3 forward squadrons. A galleas was a large multi-deck Venetian merchant galley that had been outfitted with cannons, not only on its bow, but also along its port and starboard side. Where an ordinary galley was most vulnerable, a galleas packed heavy firepower. Don Juan increased their strength of attack, packing the desks with Spanish shooters who had arquebuses, bearing their handheld, smoothbore heavy guns. Though slow-moving, these six galleasses would provide a powerful shock at the start of the battle. Doria was an admiral, but he also was a shipowner. He looked at Don Juan, raised his eyebrows, opened his palm, and offered, "There is still time, Your Grace, to avoid pitched battle." The young captain general stood surrounded by men older and with greater seafaring and military experience than he. Silence filled the small stateroom as these men waited to hear his response. He caught each of their eyes, each one of them, as he looked around. "Gentlemen," he said, "the time for council is past. Now is a time for war." It was dawn, October 7th, 1571. The Holy League rode down the west coast of Greece and turned east into the Gulf of Patras. When the morning mist cleared, the Christians, rowing directly against the wind, saw the squadrons of the larger Ottoman fleet arrayed like a crescent from shore to shore, bearing down on them under full sail. As the fleets grew closer and closer, the Christians could hear the gongs and cymbals, drums and cries of the Turks. The men of the Holy League quietly pulled at their oars. The soldiers stood on the decks in silent prayer. Priests holding large crucifixes marched up and down the decks, exhorting the men to be brave and hearing final confessions. Then the Blessed Virgin intervened. The wind shifted 180 degrees. The sails of the Holy League were filled with divine breath, driving them into battle. Now heading directly into the wind, the Turks were forced to strike their sails. The tens of thousands of Christian galley slaves who rowed the Turkish vessels felt the sharp sting of the lash, summoning them up from under their benches and demanding they take hold of the oars and pull against the wind. Don Juan knelt on the prow of Real and said a final prayer. Then he stood and gave the order for the Holy League's battle standard, a gift from Pope Pius V, to be unfurled. Catholics up and down the battle line cheered as they saw the giant blue banner bearing an image of our crucified Lord. The fleets engaged at midday. The first fighting began along the Holy League's left flank, where many of the smaller, swifter Turkish galleys were able to maneuver around Augustine's Barbarigo's inshore flank. The Venetian admiral responded with a near impossibility. He pivoted his entire squadron, 54 ships, counterclockwise, and began to pin the Turkish right flank, commanded by Mehmet Sirocco, against the north shore of the Gulf of Patras. Gaps formed in Barbarigo's line, and Ottoman galleys broke into the intervals. As galley pulled up along galley, the slaughter brought on by cannon, musket ball, and arrow was horrific. But the Venetians, in time, prevailed. Barbarigo took an arrow to the eye. But before he died, he learned of the death of Sirocco and the crushing defeat of the Turkish right line. In the center of the battle, breaking a convention of naval warfare, the opposing flagships engaged. Don Juan's Real engaged Alpacha's vessel, the Satana. Twice Spanish infantry boarded and drove Satana's janissaries back to the mast, and twice they were driven back to the Real by Ottoman reinforcements. Don Juan led the third charge across Satana's bloody deck. He was wounded in the leg, but Ali Pasha took a musket ball to the forehead. One of Real's freed convicts lopped off the Turkish admiral's head and held it aloft on a pike. The Muslim's sacred banner, with the name of Allah stitched in gold calligraphy 28,900 times, which Islamic tradition held was carried into battle by the Prophet, that banner was captured by the Catholics. Terror struck the Turks, but the fight was far from won. On the Holy League's right flank, Doria was forced to increase the intervals between his galleys to keep his line from being flanked on the south by the larger Ottoman squadron under the command of the Algerian Uluk Ali. When the space between Doria's squadron and Don Juan's grew large enough, Uluk Ali sent his corsairs through the gap to envelop the galleys of Don Juan's squadron from behind. Don Alvaro de Bazan, commanding the Holy League's reserve squadron of 35 galleries, had carefully kept his ships out of the fray until the moment when he was most needed. Now he entered the fight, rescuing the center of the Holy League from the Turkish vessels that had surrounded them, before turning his squadron south to aid the outmanned Doria. The fighting lasted for 5 hours. The sides were evenly matched and well led on both sides. But the battle turned in the Catholics' favor, and it became a rout. All but 13 of nearly 300 Turkish vessels were captured or sunk, and over 30,000 Turks were slain. Not until the First World War would the world again witness such carnage in a single day's fighting.
You have to reflect on the fasting that was done by the troops as they prepared for battle. Don Juan, to prepare himself spiritually for the battle, had fasted for 3 days. On the day of the battle, Don Juan had held high a crucifix, calling out to his men, "Do you now humble the pride of the enemy and win glory in this holy fight?" We will return after the break. This is Chuck Coughlin.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. And as you well know, I'm coming to you on BreadboxMedia.com. I'm so glad you're still listening there after the break, because what am I doing today?
Recalling to everyone's attention some of the most important pages of history about what is possibly the greatest naval battle in history that saved Europe from Muslim domination. It quite possibly preserved Catholicism when it was on the brink of extinction. As you hear the story, it may strike you, as it did me, that a shepherding hand, a tender hand, preserved us once again from the gates of hell. So let us return to the story of the Battle at Lepanto. It would be centuries before there was another battle in which so many casualties were experienced in a single day. We'll take up where we left off.
The fighting lasted for 5 hours. The sides were evenly matched and well led on both sides. But the battle turned in the Catholics' favor, and it became a rout. All but 13 of nearly 300 Turkish vessels were captured or sunk, and over 30,000 Turks were slain. Not until the First World War would the world again witness such carnage in a single day's fighting. In the aftermath of the battle, the Catholics gave no quarter, making sure to kill the helmsmen, galley captains, archers, and janissaries. The Sultan could rebuild ships, but without these men, it would be years before he would be able to use them. The news of its victory made its way back to Rome. But the Pope was already rejoicing. On the day of the battle, the Pope had been consulting with his cardinals at the Dominican Basilica of Santa Sabina on the Aventine Hill. The Pope paused in the middle of his deliberations and looked out the window. Up in the sky, the Blessed Mother favored him with a vision of the victory. Turning to his cardinals, he said, "Let us set aside business and fall on our knees in thanksgiving to God, for at this moment he has given our fleet a great victory." Perhaps you will understand why I wanted you to hear the story of the Battle of Lepanto. It has been called by some historians as the greatest naval battle in history, and it's a story we should all know. There's some interesting details. When the Catholics captured the ship of the Turkish captain, and there were shouts of victory from all the Catholics as they hoisted the flag of Christ crucified up the enemy's masthead on his leading ship. The Turks fled. They had lost 224 ships and 30,000 men. 10,000 Christian galley slaves were freed. The Turks never again attacked Christian Europe by sea. A word about Pope Pius V. A greater contrast to the popes of the Renaissance could hardly be found. As pope, he lived in a bare room, spent hours in prayer and meditation on the Passion of Christ. He wore a plain white cassock instead of rich robes. The people of Rome were so impressed with his holiness, they wanted to put up a statue of him, but of course he refused to permit it. He is now a saint. And as I said, when we celebrate the Feast of the Most Holy Rosary, it is celebrated on that day. This year and next year, it will be celebrated on that day of the great victory at Lepanto. The engagement was a significant defeat for the Ottomans, who had not lost a major naval battle since the 15th century. The defeat was mourned by them as an act of divine will. Contemporary chronicles recording that, quote, the imperial fleet encountered the fleet of the wretched infidels, and the will of God turned another way. For Catholics, this event encouraged hope for the downfall of the Turk, the Satan-like personification of the Ottoman Empire, which was regarded as a sempiternal enemy of the Christian. Indeed, the empire lost all but 30 of its ships and as many as 30,000 men, according to some sources. Some Western historians have held it to be the most decisive naval battle anywhere on the globe since the Battle of Actium of 31 BC. Despite this defeat, the Ottoman Empire did rebuild its navy with a massive effort by largely imitating the successful Venetian boat designs in a very short time. By 1572, about 6 months after the defeat, more than 150 galleys and 8 galleasses, in total 250 ships had been built, including 8 of the largest capital ships ever seen in the Mediterranean. With this new fleet, the Ottoman Empire was able to reassert its supremacy in the eastern Mediterranean. Numerous historians pointed out the historical importance of the battle and how it served as a turning point in history. For instance, it is argued that while the ships were relatively easily replaced, it proved much harder to man them, since so many experienced sailors, oarsmen, and soldiers had been lost. The loss of so many of its experienced sailors at Lepanto sapped the fighting effectiveness of the Ottoman Navy, a fact emphasized by its avoidance of major confrontations with Catholic navies in the years following the battle. After 1580, the discouraged Ottomans left the fleet to rot in the waters of the Golden Horn. Especially critical was the loss of most of the Caliphate's composite bowmen, which far beyond the ship's rams and early firearms, were the Ottomans' main weapon of naval warfare. U.S. historian John F. Gilmartin noted that the losses in this specialized class of warrior were irreplaceable in a generation. Paul K. Davis wrote that this Turkish defeat stopped Ottomans' expansion into the Mediterranean, thus maintaining Western dominance, and confidence grew in the West that the Turks, the Muslims, who had been previously unstoppable, could be defeated. The victory of the Holy League was historically important because the victory heralded the end of the Turkish supremacy in the Mediterranean. The Holy League credited the victory to the Virgin Mary, whose intercession with God they implored for victory through the use of the rosary. Andrea Doria had kept a copy of the miraculous image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, given to him by King Philip II of Spain. It was kept in his ship's stateroom. The significance of Lepanto has inspired artists in various fields. There's music written about it. There are many pictorial representations of the battle, including one in the Doge's Palace in Venice by Andrea Vicentino. This replaced Tintoretto's Victory of Lepanto which had been destroyed by fire in the 1500s. In Titian's famous painting, the allegory of the Battle of Lepanto hangs in the Prado in Madrid. The battle has also appeared in literature and poetry. G.K. Chesterton wrote a poem called Lepanto, published in 1911, and republished many times since it provides a series of poetic visions of the major characters in the battle, particularly the leader of the Catholic forces, Don Juan of Austria. To give you an idea, here's a few lines from early in the poem. For the inmost sea of all the earth is shaken with its ships. They have dared the white republics up the capes of Italy. They have dashed the Adriatic round the lion of the sea, and the Pope has cast his arms abroad for agony and loss, and called the kings of Christendom for swords about to cross. The cold Queen of England is looking in the glass. The shadow of the Valois is yawning at the mast. From Evening Isle's fantastical rings faint the Spanish gun, and the Lord upon the Golden Horn is laughing in the sun. Dim drums throbbing in the hills half heard, where only on a nameless throne a crownless prince has stirred, where risen from a doubtful seat and half-attained stall, the last knight of Europe takes weapons from the wall, the last and lingering troubadour to whom the bird is sung, that once went singing southward when all the world was young, in that enormous silence, tiny and unafraid, comes up along a winding road the noise of the crusade. Strong gongs groaning as the guns boom far, Don John of Austria is going to the war. He closes with verses linking Miguel de Cervantes, who fought in the battle, with the lean and foolish knight, who Cervantes would later immortalize in Don Quixote. Miguel de Cervantes lost the use of an arm in this battle, and therefore he is known as the one-armed man of Lepanto in the Hispanic world. The last lines of Chesterton's poem go like this. But Don John of Austria has burst the battle line, Don John pounding from the slaughter-painted poop, purpling all the ocean like a bloody pirate's sloop. Scarlet running over on the silvers and the gold, breaking of the hatches up and bursting of the holes, thronging of the thousands up that labor under the sea, white for bliss and blind for sun and stunned for liberty. Vivat Hispania, Domine Gloria, Don John of Austria has set his people free. Cervantes on his galley sets the sword back in the sheath. Don John of Austria rides home with a wreath. And he sees across a weary land a straggling road in Spain, up which a lean and foolish knight forever rides in vain. And he smiles, but not does Sultan smile, and settles back the blade, but Don John of Austria rides home from the crusade. So ending our reflection on the Battle of Lepanto, this is Chuck Coughlin. Thanks for joining us.